This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Five hours or so from puck drop between the Jets and the Ducks, game two from Anaheim, 9:30 this evening on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the National Post newspaper in Toronto, Michael Trakos. Michael, good afternoon and thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, how's it going after?
Doing very well, thanks. Michael, how are the playoffs over there in Toronto? You got gearing up?
Look at that, eh? You can resist. I've been in the playoffs, once now?
Exactly, yeah.
Hey Michael, the Blue Jays had a big win today, though.
That's true. You know what, I've been with the hockey season over in Toronto, and obviously the McDavid lottery tonight, so I think that's getting a lot of people's attention. I think everyone's kind of focus is either switch to the Raptors or the Jays, and the Jays actually have a lot of promise this year, so it's kind of fun to see, especially with a lot of the young guys they have. So that was good. Maybe with the Raptors losing, we'll see what happens tonight with the McDavid lottery, but I think that's where everyone's focus is right now.
Yeah, you still have the rubber match to come in terms of the Toronto sports scene today with the Connor McDavid lottery a little bit later on. Obviously brought you on to talk about the bloodletting in the Maple Leafs front office from earlier this week. Peter Horacek fired, no real surprise. Dave Nonis fired, no real surprise. But pretty much the entire scouting staff as well, they are also let go of their job. Are you surprised at the degree to which Brendan Shanahan has cleaned house in the Leafs front office?
I'm not surprised that he's done this. What I'm surprised at is it really that it took so long. And one of the questions was posed that if he was going to do this and he came to this conclusion eventually, why not do this right off the start? Because I think when Shanahan took over, everyone assumed that Carlisle was going to get fired, that Nonis was going to get fired, and that the scouting staff and other degrees of managerial staff were going to be let go. And it really, Brendan Shanahan has done this sort of methodically, but he's also done it just really just kind of taking his time. And he said that he wanted to make sure that he didn't make any mistakes and that he wasn't just firing for the sake of firing. But in my mind, it almost seems like we'll just wasted a season here where this is the point that they're at right now. It should have been the point that they're at a full year ago. So it's good that he's making changes. I just kind of question the fact that what fans can see it and media can see it, why couldn't the manager, the president of the organization see it? So long story short, I'm not surprised that everyone got lost their job, but just why did it take so long?
Michael, before we get into some of the potential candidates for the next GM of the Toronto Maple Leafs, you wrote an article in the National Post about 3 days ago. I don't have to tell you that because you wrote it. But as opposed to asking you about why Toronto isn't appealing, and there are many reasons why I guess it wouldn't be appealing for a general manager with Brendan Shanahan and Kyle Dubas there, but why would it be appealing for someone to want to be the general manager there?
Oh, it's simple. And Brian Burke kind of hit it on the head when he took over. The guy who ends up taking this team to the Stanley Cup and ending that drought from 1967 on, and schools are going to be named after him. Right? He'll have his own kind of holiday on the day that happens. That's how big this market is, and that's what kind of is the appeal, I think, when people say, oh, why would a Mike Babcock come here, and why would Brian Burke come here a few years ago when this is an organization that can tarnish reputations quickly, but it's the fact that if you do manage to succeed here, well, you're set for life, basically. You're going to go down in the history books as that guy who was able to make it come together. So I think that's tantalizing for a lot of people, and a lot of people with big egos would definitely be drawn to this job. But for so many other reasons, when you look at just the ownership and the pressures and the fact that there really isn't anything here to start with in terms of the rebuild. There's a lot of challenges here that says, you know what, you're better off going to a smaller market and you're better off going to a place that maybe the payoff isn't as big. But if you get it done, if Connor McDavid gets drafted, or at least win the draft and are able to get Connor McDavid, that's the best thing that could happen to the Leafs, but it's also the worst thing that could happen to Connor McDavid, I think, just because of this poor Sask. He doesn't win a Stanley Cup or win three Stanley Cups with the team. I don't know how he kind of meets those expectations.
You know, Mike, you talk about the ego aspect of taking on the job, and I certainly agree with that. But in terms of management structure, you have Kyle Dubas there and Mark Hunter there and basically nobody else there. Why would a general manager want to come into that environment with Shanahan above him, Dubas and Hunter, if not parallel to him, just slightly below him in terms of organizational standing, and you wouldn't have the control that you'd have in other environments, you'd think. So why would an established name, aside from a young up-and-coming name, why would an established name take that gig?
They wouldn't. And just for the reasons you name, you're going to have three sets of hands on a steering wheel if you're a GM there. And you've got Kyle Dubas, who's basically a GM in training. You've got Mark Hunter, who I think a lot of people believe is going to be an NHL GM sooner rather than later. And you've got Brendan Shanahan, who's basically the president of hockey ops. He's basically a GM without the experience of a GM. So if you're Pete Chiarelli, if you're Ray Shiro, this isn't the job for you. And Ben Shanahan alluded to that. He said that there are going to be some general managers who don't like this job or this job is not right for, and they're fine by that. And I think the guy that the Leafs are really targeting, without naming an actual name, or guys who are assistant GMs right now or don't have that experience where you're willing to kind of just hand over a team and say, okay, you've got free reign. I think you want someone where you're okay with having a Kyle Dubas there, or Mark Hunter there. It's basically training wheels on the job. So guys like Mike Fuda in L.A. or even a Sean Burke, if he's going to go into this first foray into management, I think they wouldn't have a huge problem with the fact that Shanahan and Dubas and Hunter are there, just because they don't have the experience to say, well, I'm going to take over. But for Peter Chiarelli, there's no way I don't think that he'd be interested in this job.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Michael Trakos of the National Post, talking about the Maple Leafs and their front office changes from earlier in the week. Michael, you look at all the scouts that were let go, and we were just talking about this last segment. You know, the timing seems a little bit curious in that, you know, the draft is still coming up in about, you know, a couple months from now, but, you know, not too far off in the future. And, you know, it doesn't take any skill to draft Connor McDavid or Jack Eichel or anything, you know, any of the, you know, the real top two or three guys. But after that, you know, that's where your scouts and your scouting staff and all your bird dogs who've been watching players, you know, in the small towns in Canada for the course of the year really, you know, earn their keep. Who's going to be running the Leafs draft in that regard, given that, you know, so many of the scouts have been fired?
Well, keep in mind that they did take out a lot of jobs in the scouting department, but a lot of those jobs are in pro scouting. And the key figures in the Leafs, which are Dave Morrison, who's their director of amateur scouting, he still has his job. Tommy Bergman, who is their European head scout, who's been responsible with finding a lot of sixth and seventh round gems, he still has his job. And when you look at Mark Hunter basically spending his whole post-playing career in the Ontario Hockey League, I think right there that you've almost inherited a scout and Kyle Dubas, who's coming from Sault Ste. Marie and will know a lot of these players as well. I think you're inheriting another guy. So they did keep a lot of their key amateur scouts, and those two guys, Dave Morrison and Tommy Bergman, are two of just a handful of guys that they did keep. So it's not like they torched everyone and are basically going to be guesswork going into this draft. So I don't think it's a huge disadvantage going into the draft without the scouts. Like I said, it's a lot of them were pro scouts, where that's going to factor into free agency. But if you're not confident in the job that a lot of those guys were doing, you know, what benefit does it have? Does it make sense to keep on to keep these guys going forward anyway? So I think Mark Hunter is going to have a huge, those are big capital letters, huge role going forward in terms of who the Leafs take in terms of, are they identifying not just size and like bottom six potential? I think they're going to be shooting for the stars and going for those top-end guys and a lot of European players as well.
Michael, I know we've talked a lot about who the next GM of the Toronto Maple Leafs is going to be, but who's the next coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs?
Yeah, Ted Nolan would be right top of my list. Just because, it's a cruel joke, but you know, if the team's not supposed to be competitive next year and you're really going to go for maybe the Austin Matthews tank job and go for the number one pick, you don't really need a Mike Babcock. You don't need a Todd McClellan. I know everyone's kind of thinking, oh, these guys are definitely going to be coaching, but let's remember, the Leafs are probably 3 to 5 years away from being competitive, if we're to believe what Shanahan's saying about this long rebuild. So why do you need a top-name guy? I think all you need is just basically a placeholder, a guy that's going to make sure you're teaching the young guys how to play proper hockey, but also that you're not winning a whole lot of games, because I think they want to be in that position where they're drafting in the top three.
Are you surprised that they didn't keep Peter Horacek for one or two more years?
You know what? That would have been nice, but also I was covering the team on a daily basis all year, so I saw how this was wearing on Peter Horacek. And you know what? It was great to see him. I don't know if I've seen him, a guy more relieved to be fired from a job, because this is just like killing him game after game to be coaching these guys that just had zero interest in putting forth like an actual effort. So not a whole lot surprised that he'd be gone. It's just unfortunate that he comes away with just a terrible record, and I hope this doesn't affect his reputation or standing in the NHL.
Michael, is there any, you know, talking about coaching, I guess, back to management for a second, is there any possibility, and if there is, maybe a percentage of on that Brendan Shanahan becomes the GM?
I've heard that you'd have him almost in the same role as Patrick Waugh is in Colorado. And no, I've never heard Mike Babcock. Sorry, that was a question, right? Babcock would do that?
No,
you said Brendan Shanahan. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got that in the mind. Sorry. So let me answer my question that you didn't even ask. But I've heard the idea that Mike Babcock would be brought in as a GM, coach / GM. And I'm throwing water on that.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way, I don't think Brendan Shanahan has any interest in being a GM, just because of the lack of experience. You got to remember, this isn't a guy that's been working for other teams in the front office. Like, to come from the NHL, where he's basically Sheriff Shanny to the Leafs and is learning on the job, he's the last guy I think I'd want working the phones and really executing a vision. So he even said that that's not a possibility. So I think the most likely scenario is that you're bringing in a guy that's green, and you're going to have that sort of management team and trying to mimic what Detroit's been doing over the last, I guess, decade or so.
It's interesting you mentioned that, though, because, you know, you're right. Shanahan doesn't have that managerial experience, and you look at Mark Hunter and Kyle Dubas. Dubas, obviously, a younger guy, was in the OHL for a while there, and Mark Hunter being in the OHL. But none of those three guys have NHL front office experience, and if you're not going to be able to convince a top-end experienced NHL executive to come in, are you going to have a bunch of guys who are green and have, you know, running your team and trying to build this thing back up for the next 4 to 5 years?
Yeah, and that's why I was almost surprised that they didn't keep Dave Notice on. And I know he wasn't a terribly popular guy in Toronto because of some of the signings he made with David Clarkson and some of the, cap mismanagement. But this is a guy that was just great at working the phone and making trades. And got to remember, he as big of a mistake as the Clarkson trade was, he was able to sort of get out from under it by acquiring Nathan Horton, who's not going to count against the cap as long as you're maximizing the salary cap. So when you're looking at a summer where you're potentially going to be moving Dion Phaneuf, Phil Kessel, and maybe a couple other names like Tyler Bozak and Joffrey Lupo, I would entrust Dave Nonis with that task, but to ask Mark Hunter or Kyle Dubas, who have zero experience in terms of making NHL trades, mm-hmm. and really when you look at that front office, the only guy there with NHL experience is Cliff Fletcher, who is essentially just the figurehead. I don't think he's actually going to be working the phones and making a trade. So that's a cause for concern. So I think while I don't think they're going to get an experienced guy, I think they still have to find someone who at least has been an assistant GM for an NHL team, who would have been making deals, but might not have the grand overall vision, is basically executing someone else's vision.
Michael Tracos covers the Toronto Maple Leafs for the National Post. Michael, appreciate your time this evening, and I guess enjoy watching the McDavid sweepstakes lottery a little bit later on.
Yeah, and enjoy your, I guess, game two. You guys seem really giddy over there over the playoffs.
Oh, you know, it's been a couple years in the making there, Michael.
No, you guys have a great team there. It's great to see the Jets. I think all of Canada is real happy that they're finally in the playoffs.
Yeah, we appreciate the support we've been getting from across the country. Thanks very much for joining us, Michael.
All right, thanks, guys.
Take care. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Let's head to break.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, big thanks to Michael Tracos for joining us to talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, Jack Edwards, voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network, is going to join us. St. Louis Blues, with just under 2 minutes to go, have been holding on for dear life against the Minnesota Wild, and they just got an insurance goal from Patrick Berglund to make it 3-1. So it appears as though the Blues are going to equalize their series with the Minnesota Wild. And earlier, the Tampa Bay Lightning handled the Detroit Red Wings by a 5-1 margin.
Jake Allen outplaying Devan Dubnyk today. Two bad goals for Dubnyk. Second and third goals.
Maybe he's finally turning back into a pumpkin or, whatever it is after, Cinderella.
As he would be the pumpkin today. He's wearing an orange shirt.
It's true. With a nice trimmed beard there. He looks sharp, I got to say. As you cut the hair, you cut the beard, you're looking good this afternoon. This segment of the program brought to you by Royal Sports. Since 1974, Royal Sports has been Winnipeg's number one hockey shop, plus so much more, like soccer to snowboards. For locations, hours, and more, check them out online at royalsports.me. If you have not yet got your whiteout gear, your jet stuff for Game 3 coming up on Monday night, or you want to wear it tonight for Game 2, Royal Sports, huge selection of Jets paraphernalia. Check them out. Boston Bruins are in the market for a new general manager, as they fired Peter Chiarelli earlier this week after the Bruins failed to make the playoffs. I take you back to January 7th and NHL midweek, where we had a topic about... And you're smirking, Richard, but it was an article that came out on January 6th where Charlie Jacobs, who is the new CEO of the company that owns the Bruins, the son of Jeremy Jacobs, longtime Bruins owner, came out, and this is early in January, and said, "I'd say without question this has been a very disappointing year. It's unacceptable the way that this team has performed, given the amount of time, money, and effort that's been spent on this team. Uh-huh. To see it delivered the way it has is unacceptable. I can tell you that at the moment it's a very fluid situation that's been monitored closely. I don't have any answers for why we're underperforming, because if I did, I would have tried them long ago." Was that the first sign that Peter Chiarelli was really in a lot of trouble? Given the Bruins struggles this year?
Yeah, Charlie Jacobs is taking an active role there, Drew, and then that was the first sign that he was in trouble. They didn't even, Claude Julien said after the year he had to get more from his players. Brad Marchand said after the year we didn't take it seriously enough. We thought we were better than we were. In this day and age when all teams are very similar, you can't play the way they did. I find it interesting, before we get into the Charlie Jacobs thing, I find it very interesting, Ezzy, that Peter Chiarelli's tenure as the Boston general manager, people are cherry-picking out the bad decisions he made. And there's going to be bad decisions over the course of a general manager tenure. Unless it's Neil Smith on the Islanders.
tenure that lasts only about 7 hours or whatever it was.
So there's going to be bad things. But, I mean, you can talk about the Sagan trade. You can talk about the Wheeler and Stewart trade, that was included on the clip that I had seen. You can talk about some of the Rask contract. And let me tell you something here. And that team, and I don't think the window's closed. You guys do. You guys think more so that it is than it isn't. And I disagree, but I do see your point, but I disagree. But I'll tell you this. He did a pretty good job there. I think he did a real nice job. He acquired Nathan Horton, played a huge role. And he was great in the cup year that they won, and the other years that they won, he decided not to re-up him. And he went through on Yager and again, like guys like that to replace him. Your guy, you brought in Chara immediately to solidify the whole organization and traded for Rask with Toronto, traded Kessel for those picks and ended up being great. You know, was able to add guys like Boychuk who were unknown. You know, I thought he did a really nice job in Boston. I would grade him very highly. He made mistakes for sure. And, you know, very few GMs are like Kenny Holland. But I mean, Peter Chiarelli, part of the brain trust of Team Canada last year, I thought rightfully so. I thought he had a very solid tenure. I'd give him a B plus. And I think that now he's being viewed as a guy who, you know, wasn't able to adjust this and that. Cap problems, sure, there are issues. But I thought he did a really nice job there. And it's kind of being shortchanged, to be honest with you.
You know, the cap problems that they talk about, I mean, they are significant in Boston. But I think it's also, they got cap problems not because he's overpaid that many players. I think they have cap problems because he acquired and drafted so well that they had to pay these players.
Well, they also, the Krejci contract has been criticized. By the time he signed the contract, guys, I mean, there's revisionist history here as far as I'm concerned on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, and you talk about early January, Drew, when Charlie Jacobs made that speech. You know, it was reported by Fluto Shinzawa, who we've had on the show before, who works for the Globe and Mail, that
in Boston Globe.
Yeah. So what did I say?
Globe and Mail.
Oh, sorry. I meant to say Boston Globe. He wrote today about how, I believe it was today. If it wasn't, it was actually, it was 3 days ago. He wrote about how in early January, Cam Neely called several high-profile players into the room. That could have been Patrice Bergeron. It could have been Zdeno Chara. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, it was high-profile players. And he didn't tell Peter Chiarelli or Claude Julien about it. And to me, why am I bringing that up? Well, I think it shows that Cam Neely wasn't happy with what was going on and excluded Peter Chiarelli and Claude Julien for that. And that's why Fluto Shinzawa brought it up in the Boston Globe. Cam Neely, of course, is the president, in addition to being a Hall of Famer. And I think that everybody now, I think Cam Neely, guys, has maybe been a little bit under the radar. He hasn't gotten maybe a lot of spotlight. As far as presidents go, you know, you talk about Brendan Shanahan and Brian Burke. I think those guys have gotten a lot more attention. Mm-hmm. Now all the attention is on Cam Neely and who he's going to hire there and what that means as far as the future for Claude Julien. Because it's possible that maybe Charlie Jacobs and Cam Neely didn't like the fact that maybe Peter Chiarelli was potentially going to fire Claude Julien. And I agree with Richie. I think everybody's now picking apart all of the bad decisions that Peter Chiarelli made. I think he did a good job as well, Richie. I think he did a great job in Boston and had Boston as a perennial contender. They missed the playoffs by a couple points here. Sure, at the end of the day, changes have to be made. But I think the Boston Bruins don't make this move if they make the playoffs. I don't think they make the move if they go out in the first round. I think that Charlie Jacobs is a guy that you hear. I don't know him personally or know him intimately as far as his story, but you hear that he makes brash decisions and he's not afraid to pull the trigger. And, you know, Cam Neely now has to decide who he wants to bring this team, you know, into the future here. And does that GM want to keep Claude Julien on? I think Claude Julien's an excellent coach. I think the Boston Bruins are in a transition period. You know, you talk about, Richie, whether the window is closing or not. It's for sure a crossroads, and it's an important time for this team.
That's
because this team, I think we'd all agree, has a very good shot at getting back into the playoffs. And if they get back into the playoffs, we know that, who knows, they can win a couple of rounds, and they might be back in the Stanley Cup Finals a couple of years from now. But I was a little bit surprised that Peter Chiarelli was fired, because when you talk about GMs that have a lot of respect and power, he was one of those guys.
I'll tell you this. You mentioned Claude Julien, too. You know they're well-respected around the league if they get fired and immediately have jobs or are coveted for jobs.
That's right.
And I think that's going to happen with both those guys, because I do think Julien probably will be let go. Apparently, Seabass has this one.
Seabass has this one. That's right. Cam Neely, of course, Seabass in Dumb and Dumber. Final in St. Louis, Vladimir Tarasenko with the first hat trick in the NHL playoffs, getting an empty net goal to win 4-1 for the Blues over the Wild. That series tied up at one game apiece with Game 3 on Monday in St. Paul. Let's head to break. When we return, Jack Edwards, the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network, is going to join us to talk more about the dismissal of Peter Chiarelli. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Gensburg. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network, Jack Edwards. Jack, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you again, boys. Too bad the Bruins aren't in it, but it's still playoff season, so that makes it a great time of year.
It is a terrific time of year, Jack, and we obviously brought you on to talk about the changes that are going to take place in the Bruins front office, Peter Chiarelli losing his job earlier this week. And we were looking back to a story from early January when Charlie Jacobs came out and was expressed his displeasure with the performance of the Boston Bruins at that time, and then obviously, lo and behold, they end up missing the playoffs by a couple of points at the end of the year. Question is, you'd heard the rumors and you'd heard that it was a possibility. When it actually happened, how surprised were you that Peter Chiarelli lost his job?
Not as surprised as I was disappointed. It's been a remarkable run for Peter Chiarelli, and if you go all the way back to the beginning of his time with the Bruins, it was widely suspected that the Bruins first offered the job to Ray Shiro, and he turned it down. And the rumors were, and I've never been able to prove this, but that he was a little bit hesitant because he didn't think he would have the kind of control that he needed, that he thought he needed. I've never been able to confirm that. And internal business discussions are internal business discussions, so you can take that for what it's worth. But Peter Chiarelli made a couple of mistakes early. One of them was hiring Dave Lewis, who is a terrific hockey lifer and a great guy, but not really cut out to be a head coach. And the Bruins played kind of systemless hockey, had a disastrous first year of Zdeno Chara's monster contract that they had signed him from Ottawa to get him. And then Lou Lamoriello made the colossal mistake of firing Claude Julien a couple of games from the end of a season in which New Jersey was about to finish second in the Eastern Conference. And New Jersey goes out in the first round, and the Bruins immediately fire Dave Lewis and hire Claude Julien. Seven consecutive playoff seasons later, the Bruins hit a perfect storm when Chiarelli traded Johnny Boychuk just days before the regular season and got two second-round draft choices back. We called it the worst trade since Jack traded the family cow for a couple of beans. But the only difference is that Chiarelli didn't come back down the beanstalk with a whole bag of gold. And because of that, the Bruins were severely challenged defensively, having lost the top four defensemen and getting nothing immediately back. Charo got hurt and had to play through the first major injury of his career and did not do well with it. And it wasn't for a lack of effort. It's just he physically couldn't perform. David Krejci never was right all season long. And Dennis Seidenberg was slow in recovering from his knee injury that happened just before New Year's of 2014. So it was a perfect storm working against Peter Chiarelli, and compounding that was the fact that he had had empty draft years in 07, 08, and 09, which is the reason that he fired everybody in his scouting department and elevated Keith Gretzky to the head scouting position in August of 2013. So he'd already worked to amend some of the problems that he had experienced. And the question is, if they bring somebody else in who does not have previous general manager experience, is his learning curve going to be similar to Peter Chiarelli's? Because Peter Chiarelli's a pretty smart guy and had a pretty good record. But what's the guarantee that anybody that they bring in from outside the organization is going to understand the nuances of this job and the potential pratfalls of it?
So, Jack, without getting into specific potential candidates for the next GM position, what do you think Bruins president Cam Neely is looking for in his next GM?
Well, he said he wanted things that a lot of club presidents and a lot of NHL head coaches want, which is a team that's good in transition, that can attack more efficiently than this year's team attacked, a team that has young players who are putting roster pressure on veterans who might not be complacent, but might not have the same kind of hunger that they had when they were in their first couple of years in the NHL, and to be a team that's going to challenge for the Stanley Cup. Given the conditions, the potential free agents in the market, and the situation that the Bruins have with older players who have restrictions on their movement or altogether no movement clauses, such as Zdeno Chara has, I don't know if that's a solvable problem in 1 year. And, you know, it's kind of strange that they're looking for a general manager in a situation where, because a guy missed the playoffs 1 year after making it 7 in a row and winning a Stanley Cup en route and getting to the Stanley Cup final and also winning a President's Trophy, the one failure to make the Stanley Cup playoffs results in an almost instantaneous firing. So, you know, maybe this was coming for a long time, but it sure looks as if one misstep cost Peter Chiarelli his job.
Yeah, you know, Jack, you mentioned all the success that Chiarelli have. I totally agree. And you look at Cam Neely, and Ezra just mentioned him, how much of a say does he want to have in personnel matters, or at least how much does he want his opinion to at least be considered?
He hasn't come out and said it. He says he wants to be the architect and have the GM and the head coach execute the blueprint. You know, he hasn't used the word architect, but that's kind of what he's gotten at. He said he's not a micromanager and that he's not going to look in on line combinations that a head coach arranges, and that he's not going to have that kind of day-to-day meddling in a general manager's job. But you have to wonder how much autonomy an incoming general manager is going to demand. One would think that anybody who's a candidate for the Boston Bruins general manager job is also qualified to be a candidate for any other opening, and there are probably going to be multiple openings for general manager jobs around the NHL. You compare and contrast your opportunities, the situation, the status of the job, perhaps, and how much control you're going to have over your own destiny. And you wonder if a highly qualified candidate from outside would demand contract language that says, look, I get the sign-off. And you know, if I'm going to sink or swim based on the result year to year, I want to at least be able to, as Bill Parcells so famously said when he was the coach of the New England Patriots, but not the general manager, and didn't have sign-off on roster stuff, he said, now, if I'm going to do the cooking, at least let me do the shopping. You know, let me decide what's in the grocery bag when we come home.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Jack Edwards. Jack is the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network. Jack, you mentioned Claude Julien earlier in the interview. Obviously, you know, he hasn't, you know, when Peter Chiarelli was let go, there's talk that Claude Julien is still going to hang around. Do you believe that he's going to be the head coach of the Boston Bruins come next season? Or do you think there's still a possibility that he gets dismissed as well?
Well, there's plenty of precedent. Because we actually went to the books and realized that when Peter Chiarelli got fired, that was the 39th general manager to lose his job since Peter Chiarelli was hired by the Boston Bruins. So in the previous 38, there were at least 8 general managers who inherited an existing head coach. So in other words, the head coach survived the GM's firing. And 8 of those guys lasted 2 seasons or more, and one of them had won a Stanley Cup before the general manager position changed. That was Randy Carlyle when Bob Murray came in taking over for Ryan Burke in Anaheim. And Carlyle kept his job for 3-plus years after Bob Murray took over. So there's plenty of precedent for Claude Julien to stick around. And when you consider that despite the stereotype that the Bruins are a slow, plodding, defensive, you know, all-D team, in 5 seasons that Claude Julien has been the coach of the Boston Bruins, they have been in the top 5 in the NHL in goals scored. And we all know how well the Bruins have played defense under Claude Julien. That has been their bread and butter. But they've also been in the top 5 in goals scored 5 times. And you know, it's not as if the Bruins just sit around and wait for other teams to shoot at their goalie and then try to win the game 1-0. The other thing that's worth noting is that the Bruins never have been out of the top 5 under Claude Julien 2 years in a row. So, you know, that there's plenty of precedent to suggest that a bounce back is coming for Boston next year if they keep Julien in there, no matter what the personnel is and no matter what system he finds himself required to play because of circumstance of different personnel that he has to work with. He's an amazingly successful coach. The only coach in Bruins history with more wins than Claude Julien is a guy that every hockey fan is familiar with, a guy named Art Ross. And Art Ross coached the Bruins five times because he was the general manager, and every time he turfed a coach, he jumped back behind the bench. So nobody has had more wins in one consecutive stretch of coaching the Boston Bruins than Claude Julien. I think that if you're an incoming GM from inside the organization or outside, you got to think really, really hard before you just whack Claude Julien.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jack. I really like Claude Julien as a coach, and I hope he's able to stay on there in Boston. Back to the vacant GM position for a second. That you got to think that that vacant GM position is still highly desirable, considering the Boston Bruins didn't miss the playoffs by much, and they've got so much young talent there. David Pastrnak had a pretty good rookie season. Torrey Krug, Dougie Hamilton, and others. You got to still think it's highly desirable of a place to work.
There's no doubt. It's an original six team. The club's working on, I believe, 254 consecutive home sellouts. There's no end in sight to that. They could sell out the 17,565 on a season ticket basis if they wanted to. It's still a hockey town, and you can tell that because people were so angry all season long because this was a Bruins team that, to a man, underachieved. Even Patrice Bergeron, who had a really, really good season, felt that he underachieved and that he didn't do enough for the team, despite the fact that, you know, he led the team in scoring and probably was a legitimate Selke candidate, although most close viewers of Bergeron don't think he deserves the award for a third time yet. But, it's a very desirable job. It's an intense hockey town. It's a hockey town where wins make people joyous and losses make people angry. It matters. And if hockey runs through your body as it does for anybody who has to work in the Boston Bruins organization, it's a place that you want to work. You want to take on that challenge.
Final question for you, Jack. People aren't very aware of Charlie Jacobs or what he's like, and frankly, we're not in this room. What is the biggest difference between Charlie Jacobs and his father, Jeremy?
Well, they're both rather reticent men, and they're both intentionally distant, and I don't know if that's a facet of their personality or a strategy of how they deal with people with whom they're involved in business. But I will tell you this, and I've known Jeremy Jacobs for more than 30 years, and I've known Charlie Jacobs for more than 20. They are dead honest, and when they tell you something, they absolutely mean it. And when Charlie Jacobs got up there in January and he said, everybody's under review, that sent shockwaves through the organization because everybody knew that when somebody named Jacobs says something that they mean it and that they were all under review. And it really got the team's attention, and they actually had their best spurt of the entire season up to that point. Now, whether that was A caused B or B just happened to follow A, I don't know, but it doesn't really matter if you're at the top of a management structure. Both Jeremy and Charlie are decision makers, and they don't make decisions lightly. Charlie described the firing of Peter Chiarelli as an iterative element, that it was a journey to get there. So it was obviously something that he has been pondering, not just for weeks, but months and perhaps years. And I suppose that anyone who is in charge of a $1 billion business, which is what the Boston Holdings of Delaware North companies are, you have to take a skeptical eye toward every single situation and imagine how it could be better, even if it's performing extraordinarily well. Because if you let it slip, mm-hmm. Then the dynasty can totter. And dynasties are not things that are supposed to totter. You know, and there's probably a healthy uneasiness about anything that approaches a feeling or even an air of complacency in the organization. And that's probably a healthy thing. It certainly isn't popular. It hasn't been popular for Jeremy or Charlie in short runs. But I think if you look at the long run record, it's pretty hard to argue with the success either on the ice or in business terms of the Boston Bruins.
Jack Edwards is the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network. Jack, we appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
boys. It's going to be a great playoffs, and go Jets.
Yeah, appreciate that, Jack. Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. See ya.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Big thanks to Jack Edwards for joining us. Big thanks to Michael Trakos for joining us before. In case you missed either of those, they will be available for download on iTunes on TSN1290.ca as well. We continue our look at the first round series by making a stop in Music City, USA.
Nashville and Chicago.
Which explains why Remus is playing country music right now. At least I presume that's why it explains why Remus is playing country music right now. That series tied up at one game apiece heading into Chicago for Game 3, and two big pieces of information coming out ahead of Game 3. First, new starting goaltender for the Chicago Blackhawks is going to be Scott Darling after Corey Crawford had been absolutely lit up in the first two games of the series. Blackhawks were down 3-0 in Game 1 after the first period, and they ended up winning that game after Darling comes in and shuts down the Predators. And we'll talk about that. And then the second big piece of information, Shea Weber, not going to be in the lineup for the Nashville Predators. He will not even travel to Chicago, so he's going to miss games 3 and 4 at least with a lower body injury. Can the Predators win the series without Shea Weber?
Well, yes.
Yes.
I think they can.
Okay.
Because I think their roster is constructed similar to the Jets. If you're going to look at the one big strength on that roster, aside from Pekka-Rinne, it's right side D. Seth Jones looked good, real good. You have Cody Franzen and you have Ryan Ellis. You can adequately fill that spot. You're not going to replace Shea Weber, but you're going to replace him a heck of a lot better than most other teams would. So it affects their chances for sure, but it doesn't completely send them off the deep end and say they're done.
Yeah, and Chicago has had all types of problems in goal. Corey Crawford, who had an excellent season, kind of underrated season in my opinion, and he's really struggled. And Scott Darling, as you mentioned, Drew, was really good in Game 1. I think he made 42 saves in the Chicago victory, Duncan Keith getting that overtime winner. And, you know, Shea Weber is one of the best defensemen in the NHL, as Richie mentioned. They could probably beat the Chicago Blackhawks. The Chicago Blackhawks, I mean, you watched the game yesterday, and 6-2, I mean, it really fell apart. It wasn't, I think, as bad as the score indicated. Mike Santarelli getting that sixth goal, but
Blackhawks had the lead, relatively, you know, at least halfway through that game.
Yeah, so the Chicago Blackhawks are certainly going to have to get their goaltending game in order, and I wouldn't be surprised if Scott Darling plays well, they go with him. Scott Darling's an interesting story. He was a draft pick of the Chicago Blackhawks and didn't really get a chance into the NHL until in his mid to late 20s. I think he's 26 or 27 now. Played really well in the ECHL and the AHL, and actually played pretty well earlier this season for the Chicago Blackhawks when Antti Raanta was injured. So I think it's a nice story, and Scott Darling's proved that he can play in the NHL in both the regular season and the playoffs. It's not what we expected, but again, Joel Quenneville, in this all-important Game 3, has made the decision. He's going to make that decision now, and it brings up the question, well, if Scott Darling struggles, I guess you have to go back to Corey Crawford, but the Nashville Predators, to me, are still not as good as a team as the Chicago Blackhawks. I think they've overachieved this year, but again, you know, back to Shea Weber, you're going to have to pick up the slack. He plays big time minutes. Mm-hmm. Roman Josi plays the same amount of minutes his defense partner, and now others are going to have to step up.
Well, they will, Ezzy. And you talk about the goaltending problem. Chicago's kind of gone through that before. I mean, they know they've never played. And Corey Crawford, due respect to him, because he has played well over the years and probably not gotten maybe the respect that he deserves. I've never been totally sold on him, but he has had spurts, Ezzy, and like as you mentioned, like we're long. Portions of seasons where he's been really good, and of course he has a cup. So, granted, Antti Niemi has a cup, and I'm not completely sold on him either. All that being said, the Hawks never go into these series with Carey Price in net. It's just part of the game, so it's part of the deal for them. So, I don't think it's gonna make them a little as flustered as maybe a young team. And this is a real experienced squad too, right?
Sure.
So I you look at. From the Nashville perspective, you look at the ice time. You know, obviously, Weber leaves the game yesterday and only plays 13 and a half. But Seth Jones is at 21 minutes. Okay, guys, Cody Franzen's at 16 minutes. and Ryan Ellis is at 20. You bump Seth Jones up to 25, 26, and you give Franzen a lot more ice time. There are guys there who can make up that ice time. Again, will it be as good as Shea Weber? Certainly they'll miss his shot in the power play, all those things. But all the guys I mentioned are good offensively, too. Like, they're good players. So I think they can withstand it. Can they withstand it for the long haul? Probably unlikely, but I think they can certainly withstand it for the short term.
Sure, Cody Franzen actually was a healthy scratch in Game 1.
That's what I mean.
And
well, that's why it didn't make sense when they... I mean, I guess now it makes sense to have acquired him to lose Weber, but, yeah, but why acquire a guy, the biggest strength of your team, when you can acquire a scorer, which we thought would help them?
Sure. I mean, absolutely, and that's something we discussed at the trade deadline. A lot of... By the way, Antoine Vermette, also a healthy scratch in Game 1. I have to double-check if he played yesterday.
No, he didn't.
So, healthy scratch the first two games of this series for the Blackhawks. So, a lot of trades at the trade deadline weren't very good.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of guys who've been healthy scratched.
That's what I mean, yeah. But, and people say that all the time, and it's overrated. Sure, and if Gabrick doesn't go to LA last year, I don't think they win the Cup. So, it goes both ways.
Yeah, it absolutely goes both ways.
Stepniak has been real good here.
Yeah, they worked out here in Winnipeg, but, I mean, you look at Kimmo Timonen hasn't been anything to write home about either for the Blackhawks. Only played 10 minutes and 50 seconds last night.
That was a calculated risk.
Sure.
Not too even calculated, just a risk. I mean, he hadn't played at all, so they didn't know what they were getting.
Right.
But he's such a smart player that you thought it was worth a while for that bottom pairing.
Yeah, and if you had said that Antoine Vermette's not going to be able to crack the lineup of the Chicago Blackhawks after they acquired him at the trade deadline, most people would say that you're crazy.
I still think he'll have a pretty big role coming down here.
Well, I mean...
He'll check in for Game 3.
You think... Especially after the... The Blackhawks, I mean, you can certainly make the argument. They were, dramatically outplayed yesterday, obviously, given the score, which, the 6-2 final, and they were outplayed in Game... you can make the argument they were outplayed in Game 1. They turned it on after, sleepwalking through that first period.
They got the split, Drew.
I know, and they're happy with taking the split. I mean, they got Patrick Sharp going for the first time
all year
as well.
That's
so
right.
All of a sudden, they're a little bit more dangerous. And, Patrick Kane has looked fantastic in the first two games coming back from injury. He scored yesterday for the Blackhawks. So, I mean, I still think this is the Blackhawks series to win, given... especially without Shea Weber in the lineup. And I understand that the Predators can probably handle it to some degree, losing Shea Weber, but, they can handle it for a couple games. I think at some point in time, the Blackhawks' superior talent will win out, especially when,
They need some saves, though.
They need some saves, right. And that's why, Scott Darling has only got these good vibes behind him. I'm sure he's a rookie, a rookie in terms of his playoff experience in the NHL. But he came into that Game 1 with no pressure on him, because they were already down 3-0, and he stood on his head. Now when he's, how much more pressure is on him now that he's going to be the starting goaltender for Game 3, and there's no buffer and there's no room for error. Whereas, in Game 1, there's a ton of room for error. If he gives up a couple goals in Game 1 when you're down 3-0, who cares? You're still losing,
That's a lot of goaltending. I mean, if Pavel gives up 5 goals today or Anderson gives up 5 goals today, we're going to be hearing for Hutchinson or Gibson. That's just what'll happen.
Yeah, well, that's what happens in the playoffs, especially, like you said, the pressure ramps up. There's no, it's a best of 7, so you can't let a player necessarily play himself out of whatever struggles he's going through, which is, the case of Corey Crawford. Right now, he doesn't really seem as though he can stop a beach ball. So you go to Darling, you give Crawford the time, let him work in practice, let him make some saves in practice, let him get his game back under him if you need him. And if Darling takes the ball and
he
runs with it,
right.
Great for the Blackhawks. Like you said, they've never had, a clear-cut, world-beating goaltender, so they're okay going with a guy who's got a little less experience and relying on, the Duncan Keiths and the Brett Seabrooks the Patrick Kanes and the Jonathan Toews and the Patrick Sharps and the Marian Hossas to really drive the team.
You list the whole roster here?
That's about all the guys. Do you want me to Tuvo Teräväinen, too? He's going to be huge. How about that? That good now?
And it's going to be easier because Scott Darling is playing in front of a home crowd, but it's, you saw Philip Grubauer go in net for the Washington Capitals yesterday in place of Braden Holtby, so the onus is on the team to play better.
And Grubauer wasn't even that good, as he, but it was the team played better in front of him, I thought, because they thought they had to compensate a bit for it as well.
Sure. Let's head to break. Why don't we talk about that series when we come back? We'll look at some of the other series going on in the NHL's Stanley Cup playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Hey, 5:30 in the evening here on TSN 1290. 4 hours until puck drop. Game 2 between the Jets and the Ducks in Anaheim. You can hear it live on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Knott Auto Corp. Be sure to visit their beautiful new luxury auto and art gallery at the corner of Waverly and McGilvery. They have their grand opening sale on right now. For more information, check them out online at knottautocorp.com.
New York Islanders and Washington.
Richie, you said that you caught a lot of the Islanders-Washington game last night, game 2 between those two teams, the Islanders winning game 1 in Washington and then the Caps bouncing back to even the series up one game apiece heading to Long Island. Braden Holtby, sort of all-world goaltender, sort of under the radar a little bit, but tremendous goaltender for the Capitals. Didn't play yesterday, out with an illness. They call up Philip Grubauer from the AHL, and he does enough. Isn't great, isn't perfect, but he does enough to give the Capitals, allow them to tie up the series at one game apiece.
A couple things on this one, Drew. The first one is that the Islanders didn't touch the puck after the second period started. Washington looked pretty good to me. I mean, controlling the puck down low. Washington has a significant size advantage against the Islanders' defense. I mean, Barry Trotz even said it, I believe, during game 1 in one of the in-game interviews. Why they're doing interviews with the coaches in the middle of a playoff game on the bench is another day, but for another day. But Barry Trotz actually answered the question, so maybe that's why. The size was just cycle down low, cycle and cycle, and the Islanders could not defend it. The Islanders desperately missed Travis Hamonic back there. Forget even the Ovechkin matchup, which obviously they miss him for that. They need the size in the 23 to 24 minutes. See, the difference is we talk about Shea Weber. We talk about, say, Dustin Byfuglien or whoever it is here. Well, the difference is in the with the Islanders, they have Brian Strait or Calvin DeHaan taking the spot of these guys. And they just, like, Brian Strait, these are not, or Hickey and Vishnovsky, they're not big enough. They can't replace him. They can't replace Hamonic with a similar player or a player of even within the same ballpark of talent and toughness. So Washington, with the size advantage anyways, putting the puck down low and creating a chance off the cycle, and they can create off the rush too, although they've done a real good job of just continuing the puck in the offensive zone, and the Islanders aren't getting the puck. So in transition, sometimes the Islanders will get a transition rush and the puck's back in there for 30 seconds again. Sure. That's a huge problem. Why Trotz ever broke up Ovechkin and Backstrom, I don't know. But Pierre McGuire says last night in the broadcast, and you have to give Barry Trotz a lot of credit that he decided to put Backstrom and Ovechkin back together because then they started scoring. I was like, well, I mean, I like Barry Trotz as a coach. He's done a real good job there, but I mean, he's the one who took him apart in the first place. Sure. Backstrom was creating chances early in the game, and the guys weren't capitalizing. He put them back together. To me, it changed the game, and not overly surprisingly. And if they're going to be more of a one line offense and kind of three contributing lines, that's what they've done all year, and that's made them successful. So, if I'm Washington, I'm feeling pretty good about my game going to Long Island. But if I'm the Islanders, I didn't play very well in game 2. Got game 1, played pretty solid in that game, played a real solid game. Going back home, it's your last kick at the can in Nassau Coliseum. Grabowski maybe coming back. You got your split. You know, skill-wise, you have an advantage on this team. And Halak, I mean, Halak's been pretty solid. I mean, you could take issue with a goal or two, but overall, I mean, he's not letting the pucks just completely through him all the time. And he seems pretty confident. So I think both teams are feeling good here, which leads me to believe, as I did when the series started just a couple days ago, that it'd be a 7-gamer because it's an interesting one. It's a lot of storylines.
Ezzy, what are your thoughts on the two games that we've seen between the Caps and the Islanders so far? And, you know, to Richie's point about the size being a difference maker between the two teams so far.
I think it's been close as we expected it to be, and I think especially yesterday you saw that Travis Hamonic was definitely missed, and I think that the Islanders as a whole have to play better defensively. I don't think Yaroslav Halak played particularly well last night, and I thought Nicklas Backstrom really had one of the best games that I've seen him play in a long time. I still think, you know, that this game is, as Richie mentioned, going to go down to 7 games. And I think that the Islanders, I think, have the advantage as far as depth in their forward lines. But I think when you talk about Alexander Ovechkin, Nicklas Backstrom, and I think, you know, Joel Ward, they've added him to that line. And I think that was a smart move by Barry Trotz. I think that the Washington Capitals are still very much in the series, and I think they were the desperate team, and you're going to see the desperate team many times, especially at home. They're going to come out with an effort like that, and even though it was close, and I think that, you know, the New York Islanders are going to be pumped up having a playoff game there at Nassau Coliseum. They're going to want to win in front of their home crowd, but I still think that, you know, this group of Islanders, I think, with, you know, Richie mentions Brian Strait and Thomas Hickey, or younger defense, pardon me, smaller defensemen, I still think that they'll be able to get the job done.
And another thing is, you know, the Islanders have that 3-1 lead yesterday, but really, I mean, they didn't deserve that 3-1 lead. So it's not one of those games where they all played them and blew a lead and are going to feel bad about themselves. They didn't deserve to win that game. It was a terrible turnover for the fourth goal. I think it was DeHaan in front. It's a brutal play, but they just were getting outplayed, and the pressure was on all game. So
doesn't that speak to the sort of the impact of losing Travis Hamonic? Is that the Capitals are able to? I mean, in the in-game, you know, on a game by game basis, they're able to exert their will physically against the smaller Islanders. But then the toll it takes, and we've heard about these, sort of the cumulative effects of, you know, the physicality game after game, shift after shift. And you look at the Islanders on the back end. You know, Johnny Boychuk's got decent size, 6'2", 225, so he's okay.
Oh, he's a big boy.
He's a big boy. But everybody else is almost, you know, barely over 200 pounds, and Strait's the only guy who's 6'1", 205. Everyone else is under 200 pounds, so you work it in deep, and, you know, sort of like you've seen, the Jets are going after Sammy Vatanen, putting the puck into that corner.
Only one guy in Anaheim to do that. Similar to Winnipeg, there's only one guy to do it.
Of course, and the Ducks, you know, exactly. The Ducks are putting it in after Toby Enstrom. You can't do it against the other pairings, but, you know, on the Islanders, you can do it pairing after pairing after pairing.
You really only could do it to one pairing before, because you had Boychuk or Hamonic on the ice at all times with the Islanders.
Right.
And now you're going to have that. Then you could take advantage of a third pairing of, say, Hickey and Vishnovsky if you want to, but those guys move the puck pretty nice. So
yeah, but they move it. They're decent for in terms of puck moving, but the Capitals can still go in, get in on them, and can still lay the body on them.
That's been the problem,
and that's where the biggest problem right now, the biggest adjustment so far for the Islanders in Game 3 probably has to be in that area.
And as you mentioned, Backstrom, dominant performance last night. Totally agree. He's as good as any player. He looked as good as any player has looked in this playoffs thus far.
Yeah. Let's quickly shift focus to the Game 2 that happened earlier today between the Red Wings and the Tampa Bay Lightning. Series now tied up at one game apiece as the Lightning get the win on home ice against the Red Wings earlier today. You know, the Lightning dominated game one, just sort of were on the wrong end of the score sheet there. Yeah. Now you have two games in the books here, and so far the Lightning have easily been the better of the two teams, but one game apiece, Detroit's got to take that heading home to Joe Louis Arena.
Yeah, I mean, the Lightning are feeling real good about themselves. Outplayed them in both games. They got a split, but they feel good. And if you're Detroit, you mentioned Drew, you're really on the back of Mrazek and Datsyuk, because a great performance that Datsyuk had. Mm-hmm. He looked like his ankle was bothering him today. They'd be done if he wasn't able to perform. The Detroit defense has had some trouble, and you know, the Lightning are very deep up front. They're fast, and they move the puck real nice. We had mentioned on the preview show that this is a prime matchup for Tampa, and that they're not playing against a big, tough team. And they're kind of doing what they want out there.
Sure.
And they look pretty good in doing it. But that doesn't mean that it'll happen in every series. But nothing I've seen in that series would lead me to believe that Detroit's prime for an upset. Yeah. Especially now with Howard in today. They scored on Howard, too.
Yeah, like, I mean, Mrazek was great in game one. First playoff game, and he was tremendous for them. But today, you know, not that many of the goals were weak goals, per se, but the Lightning were just able to exert their will. And just Detroit didn't have any answers for him. We saw that. I mean, I think it was the third goal that occurred when we were, here in studio, or maybe the fourth goal at that point in time, where I think it was Tyler Johnson, you know, shot, rebound, and, you know, the defenseman on the play.
Was
that Jonathan Erickson, right?
It was Erickson. I don't know if I remember. It was Killorn. I forget who it was. It was a left-handed guy. But yeah, Drew, it wasn't a great defensive play, and Detroit doesn't, you know, have that great top ND. Move the puck nice, but they don't defend all the time particularly well. And when you're playing with the puck a lot in the offensive zone, as in the neutral zone, if you're Detroit, you're going to be okay with the defense. But when you're playing against a team that has it more than you do, when you have to defend, it's a different ballgame. And they're having some trouble doing that.
Yeah, this is the best offensive team in the NHL, the Tampa Bay Lightning. Yeah. And they have a lot of different weapons. And if it's not 91, it's other players. And that's going to be the problem for the Detroit Red Wings. And again, Peter Mrazek doesn't have a lot of NHL playoff experience, was good in game one, wasn't good in game two. So there's some question marks for this Detroit Red Wings team. And again, I think it's still going to be a close series, but I ultimately like Tampa. I think they're going to run into some problems with teams like Washington and the Rangers, as Richie mentioned, more physical teams.
Yeah, but those teams won't be a problem for them until at least the conference finals. Because after this series, you know, assuming Tampa gets through, and I'm assuming that given the way they've played for the first two games, you're going to have the situation where the where they play the Canadiens or the Senators in the second round.
Yeah, and the Senators are more physical than the Canadiens, but yeah.
Certainly. And the Senators, of course, down 2-0, so they still have to bounce back against the Habs before they can start looking ahead to the second round.
Tampa went 5-0 against the Habs this year. I mean,
so that's what probably has to give them a nice boost of confidence.
But no, but I don't think anybody ever is champion at the bit to play Carey Price.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, Carey Price, if there's any goalies that can steal series, it's Carey Price and probably Pekka Rinne. For the Predators, those are the two goalies. If you look around the league, that's the only two that are probably able to steal series. You wouldn't be shocked about it happening.
Yeah.
You look at all the other goaltenders, and you know they're good because you have to be pretty decent to get this far. But they have some warts. You know, you're not shocked to see a weak goal get let up by any of the other goaltenders. Braden Holtby is probably the third best goaltender in the playoff. Maybe Lundqvist. Lundqvist over Holtby, just given probably reputation almost more than anything. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll look at a couple more series. We'll look back at the Jets and the Ducks game two later on this evening.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One final segment this Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, depending on what time you declare evening to have started here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Programming note, NHL midweek Thursday. So coming up on Thursday of next week, I believe that is the 23rd. If I'm not mistaken, it is. So 23rd for NHL midweek. That'll be after the conclusion of Game 4 between the Jets and the Ducks. Of course, Game 2 goes later on this evening, 9:30 p.m. puck drop in Anaheim. You can hear the game live on TSN 1290. Of course, Bayak, Knighty, Edmonds, they'll have the call for you as the Jets look to equalize the series in a key matchup of Game 2 as between the Jets and the Ducks this evening.
Yeah, the Jets are looking to get back into the series, of course, and the fans here are waiting for the whiteout, so they know that as soon as this game is over, they're coming back to arguably the loudest fans in the NHL. So it's going to be an awesome game. It's going to be a little bit late again tonight.
Stay up late, you figure?
So it's going to be an exciting one. They played very well, and they took some bad penalties, and that's all that takes against a team like the Anaheim Ducks. I have no problem. I think they'll be ready to respond.
What's your key to the game? Is it anything different than it was in Game 1? Or is there an X-factor sort of player that you're looking at to maybe drive the bus a little bit harder and that can lead the Jets to the victory?
I think there's some players that on the Winnipeg Jets didn't have their best games. I think the Andrew Ladd, Brian Little line didn't have their best game, so you're expecting a little bit more out of that line. And I think Paul Maurice, you got to think, saw that as well. I thought the Blake Wheeler, Mark Scheifele, Drew Stafford line was the best line, which it has been for the last couple months since Drew Stafford came over from the Buffalo Sabres. I think Dustin Byfuglien's got to be more of a factor. He's got to be jumping in more on the rush. But I think for the most part, the Winnipeg Jets have played a very structured defensive system. And I think that the Winnipeg Jets, when they're the most successful, are taking time and space away from other teams. And I think you saw that for spurts in the game against the Anaheim Ducks, especially in the first period. I thought they came out with a lot of energy. And I think you want to see more of a 60-minute effort. Third period, I think they got away from that a little bit.
You mentioned the first period, and that certainly, to my mind, was the best period that the Jets had in Game 1. If they play 60 minutes like they played in the first period, you'd probably be pretty confident in what the final result's going to be.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, Drew. I think that the Winnipeg Jets, even though they've had not a lot of success against the Anaheim Ducks this year, I think that you want to see more physicality, and I think the Jets too. I think you got away from really how they used their speed off of the rush. I think that was something that didn't work out a lot in Game 1.
You know, and you talk about that, and the speed is certainly an advantage for the Jets in this series, as they're the faster of the two teams. Physically, you know, both teams certainly play a strong physical game.
Yep.
So, you know, I think it is off the rush that's going to be a key for the Winnipeg Jets, because, you know, throwing it in deep and sort of the cycle game isn't necessarily going to be as effective against the Anaheim Ducks as it would be some other teams, even though the Jets are certainly skilled at that. But, you know, I think... You know, certainly the speed factor is going to be one thing the Jets need to improve on or utilize for the entire 60 minutes. It also still, to me, comes back to how do you neutralize Getzlaff and Perry? And certainly coaches throughout the NHL have been asking that question for probably half a decade or longer at this point in time. But if you're Paul Maurice, you know, is it just a function of you have to sort of, you're going to put your guys right up against them and try to, you know, limit their freedom with the puck and just be almost right up, you know, have a man have their body against them to make sure that they physically just don't have the room to do as much as they were able to do in game one?
Yeah, I think that's always a key. I think you always want to be physical with those guys. And, you know, for the Winnipeg Jets, it's also a question of when you possess the puck, you make sure that those guys don't have it. And I think they've been a good possession team all year, but specifically Getzlaff and Perry, they got to control those guys. They really hurt them in game one.
Any concerns at all with, you know, there's sort of a hangover from the way the game one ended? The Jets were in it certainly for the first 40 minutes. They had the lead after the second period. And then the third period comes where the Ducks, you know, really dominate, you know, get the three goals to win 4-2. You know, any concern that sort of the bad feelings for how game one ended carry over to game two, or just a complete clean slate for the Jets to go forward with?
You got to hope that they don't, because they could run into problems if they do that.
Okay, some other action from the other playoff series that have taken place. You got the Rangers and the Penguins. They'll have game two later on this evening, I believe, a 7:30 or so puck drop in that one. The Rangers win game one. Not a dominant effort, but you know, it's amazing how listless and how lifeless the Pittsburgh Penguins look. You know, in a game that was probably to some degree there for the taking, Malkin and Crosby, you know, the headlines in the Pittsburgh papers are, you know, have you seen either of these two guys, as they've been sort of invisible, very few shots on goal for either of those guys in game one. You know, do you have any reason to believe that the Penguins are going to be able to bounce back and make a series of it, given how they've struggled down the stretch here?
Well, if Evgeny Malkin and Sidney Crosby aren't contributing, probably not, Drew, but I think the Rangers are just too much to handle. I think especially getting Keith Yandle at the trade deadline, just improving a defense that's already one of the best in the league. But I'm not saying that I don't think the Pittsburgh Penguins can come back and win a couple games here, but I think they're going to have a real problem winning the series. And I think Sidney Crosby, there's something going on with him. I think there's something going on with this team. I think that there's a lack of an identity with this team this year, and I think that they're not good enough offensively to make up for the slowness that they have on the back end. So I think, you know, it'll be huge if they can split the series and go back to Pittsburgh and regain home ice advantage. And, you know, I thought they did some good things in that game, but I think, again, Crosby and Malkin are the keys, which is obvious. I think anybody can tell you that. So for the New York Rangers, I think, you know, they really got the best first-round matchup that you could ask for.
Yeah, you look at the Penguins' performance in game one, Sidney Crosby, one shot on goal. And I know the Rangers have a good defense, but one shot on goal for Sidney Crosby. Malkin had two. You know, the time on ice there. I know you're the Pittsburgh Penguins. I know you can't drive these guys in, you know, into the ground, but you're only playing Malkin 17 and a half minutes. It was a 2-1 game. It's not like this was a blowout where you don't need to play those guys, but 17 and a half minutes for Malkin, 19 minutes and 11 seconds for Crosby. You got to play two of the best players in the NHL, two of the best players in the world for longer than that, don't you?
I think so. I think Mike Johnston must have had a reason for that. I'm not sure what it was, but yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Drew.
I know you don't know the answer, but I mean, unless it's injury and these guys just don't have physically able to perform better, how do you not put those guys out there for over 20 minutes in game one of the playoffs in a one goal game? It just seems bizarre to me. I know you're trying to, you don't want to ruin them, and you don't want to, exhaust them in the first round. But if you don't get out of the first round, what does it matter? You got to ride your horses. We say it on this show, for years at this point, ride your horses. And I don't know if that's a function of maybe the inexperience of Penguins head coach Mike Johnson coming, at least the NHL inexperience there, but to not have Malkin or Crosby over 20 minutes, you don't have a forward over 20 minutes in that. So, I mean, you're telling me that, David Perron at 16 and a half minutes or Max Lapierre at 11:45 there, you got to give those minutes to Crosby and Malkin in my mind more than you can give them to some of your lesser weights, especially in a one goal game.
Yeah, I don't know what there is much more to say about it. I think that these players are paid the salaries that they get, and they're two elite players. And again, I think those players, even though they didn't have their best seasons, I think there's something else going on there with this team, whether it's in the dressing room. They just don't seem like a team that realizes that they're in a playoff series of against a team that is to me better than them. And it's tough to kind of understand why Crosby and Malkin only got that ice time, and we'll have to see if they get more. I would imagine they get more ice time tonight in game two.
You would hope so. Otherwise, it might be 2-0 for the New York Rangers in that series very quickly. And obviously the Penguins, given their struggles, struggles offensively. Who knows if they're ever going to be able to bounce back from a 2-0 deficit. The other series, it's now tied up at one game apiece. The St. Louis Blues defeating the Minnesota Wild by a 4-1 margin in a game that was actually much closer than that than the score demonstrated. It was a 2-1 game until there were 2 minutes to play. Patrick Berglund then got an insurance marker, and then Tarasenko into the empty net. Really, Jake Allen standing on his head in this game, making 24 out of 25 saves, including a number of desperation saves late in the game when the Wild were pushing to equalize. They went with Jake Allen. We thought that was the right decision. I think Ken Hitchcock's been vindicated after a bad game one for the St. Louis Blues. They bounce back and get the all-important game two victory.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the game was closer than the score indicated, and there's no reason to believe why the rest of this game won't be close. And Jake Allen, he's got a lot to prove. This is his net now. It's pretty clear that Ken Hitchcock has decided to go with him, and he responded by having a good game here. And I think Vladimir Tarasenko with the hat trick, I think he's showed what I guess he was. In game one, he wasn't his best, and he's one of the most elite scorers in the NHL now, and he had a real strong game. And it's going to be exciting. The series is going back to Minnesota. They've got great fans in Minnesota, and can't wait for game three.
Yeah, that's actually, it's absolutely a great series. And Tarasenko, he brings an element to the Blues that they haven't had the last couple of years, that top flight sort of superstar offensive talent. And sure, the third goal is into the empty netter, but the first two were, early in the game to put the Blues on the right foot, scoring two goals in the first period for the Blues to give them that lead. And that series tied up at one, heading back to St. Paul on Monday night.
Let's go live.
Not sure why we're going to the hotline there, Remo, but that's close enough. That's the one, the Foo Fighters song. Close enough there, Remo. That's it for us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on this Saturday afternoon. Big thanks to our guest, Jack Edwards from the New England Sports Network, and Michael Trakos from the National Post. In case you missed any of it, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, get a sent to your iPod each and every week. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, Royal Sports, and Not Auto Corp. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Michael Remus and analyst Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for Hustler and Lawless live from Anaheim.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.